Thanks so much for joining in on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Time to take a look at weather and climate with our guest, one of our weather guys with us today, John Martin, professor, former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Great to have him with us. And if you have a weather or climate question, I hope you'll join in for this last half hour. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. John Martin, good to see you.
Good to see you, Larry. How are you?
I'm pretty good.
Good.
Steve Ackerman's is under the weather a little bit
yes,
today.
Yes, he is.
So you've got it for a half hour. Precipitation, let's talk about that just to begin with. Last May was the 10th wettest on record in Wisconsin. We had an average of more than 5.5 inches of precip falling statewide last May.
Yeah.
How likely is it we'll see that again?
Well, I don't think I've seen any forecast from the Climate Prediction Center that zeroes in on that in terms of saying, you know, we're going to have a repeat of May and June. To remind people, June last year was even worse in terms of being wet here in Dane County. So there's no apparent forecast for that to be repeated this year. But I don't know if that's, you know, going to be the way that it turns out. You can get thunderstorm activity can just give you a huge amount of rain, even though it's really hard to predict even hours in advance.
Yeah. Robert had sent us an email. He cites a Washington Post article that this has been the windiest spring in 50 years. Mm. He wondered if you have any thoughts on that.
Well, it's a really interesting phenomena that you can measure that, and it's verifiable to measure that. And my colleague Andrea Lang and myself have tried, now we're trying for the third time with National Science Foundation on a proposal to investigate the transition, interannual variability of the transition from winter to spring. And this is exactly the kind of thing that we're interested in trying to understand better. How do you go from one year to the next where you get such, you know, large differences between the windiness and then that's pollen transport in April, in a windy April. And so that does something to the flora and fauna. So it's a really interesting question with lots of dimensions. And how do we transition from winter to spring from one year to the next, and why is it different?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, wind makes me think about tornadoes.
Yeah, oh, gee.
Last May was a busy month in Wisconsin for tornadoes. I think it was 22 of the state's 24 tornadoes happened during May.
Yeah. It was a weird May last year, as you pointed out, first with the precipitation. Because, you know, one of the things that characterized May last year was an abundance of thunderstorms. We didn't get any tornadic storms, I don't think, in Dane County, or at least not in Madison last May. But we did have a lot of thunder. It seemed like a really early start to the thunder season for us. And again, whether or not that's repeated this year or not is just hard to say. And apparently no obvious factors pointing towards that in the current forecast.
It does seem to me, at least, that tornado activity, if you look at the nation, it's shifting a little bit. There seems to be a lot more tornadic activity on the east, along the east coast and southeast.
Well, Victor Gensini down in Northern Illinois University, in collaboration with Harold Brooks, I think, at the Storm Prediction Center, they did a really interesting study that I'm not going to get the year right, but it's not that old, where they found clear evidence that Tornado Alley, the frequency maximum region in the central plains of the U.S., south central plains, has moved slightly eastward and moved up in the calendar year a little bit. So there are some changes that are going on with the main tornadic activity. But then, as you point out, stuff on the periphery, east coast tornadoes and whatnot, are a lot more rare. But they're becoming, apparently, increasingly common. And that is fairly interesting and not quite well explained or understood yet.
Yeah, I know the National Weather Service reported last year that there were 552 tornadoes nationwide. Mm. And usually by the end of April, that was as of last week, that there had already been. Mm. And usually by the end of April, there's about 330.
Yeah, and part of the interesting thing about tornadic activity in the United States is that it comes in different regions in different seasons. February and March are sort of peak times for the southeast United States, the Carolinas, Georgia, parts of Mississippi, and Alabama. And then it moves to the Central Plains or thereabouts in April and May, and then moves toward the Great Lakes and, you know, southern Great Lakes, western Great Lakes until in June and July. So there are different foci across the country at different times of the year. So if one gets a head start, then the whole count for the season for the whole country has gone way up. And I don't know whether or not there was a, you know, unusually large number in the southeast. I know Arkansas got hit fairly badly over the month of March, which is a little bit unusual for them. It's more east of them usually that happens. So little things around the edge can get you going in a direction that leads to a big rally in the numbers by the end of April.
Cater, I think it is, in Herbster.
Yeah, hello.
Hi, what's on your mind?
The bizarre snowfall last winter. I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts about the bigger system causes of that, like the jet stream and climate change. I mean, what happened there?
A lack of snow you're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah, it's in fact, it's not just a lack. It's a good question. It's not just a lack of snow. It's a lack of precipitation. We were about average for the wintertime, I guess, in precipitation, but most of it was in the rain form of rain. So underlying that is probably the fact that we were, you know, warmer than normal for extended periods of time, and that's not hard to imagine being tied to changes in the climate, because that'll generally be the case. We'll have a bias toward being a little warmer than normal, but we were sufficiently warmer than normal to miss out on some of those precipitation events being snow as opposed to being rain. And so that's local to last year. That's not just climate change. There's something strange about the nature of the storm track that kept us on the warm side of too many of those events. We didn't get our fair share of the colder ones. And there was no obvious thing that I noticed as it was happening in the circulation over North America that would have led to that. But, you know, these are the kind of things that are more easily detected and probably better investigated in their aftermath than they are as they're occurring. So maybe over the summertime, among the things that I get to do finally when I'm free to think every day, 5 days a week, looking at things exactly like that are a personal interest of mine, and I really do like to follow up and figure out what might have happened circulation-wise, broad-scale circulation, as you point out, over last winter.
Yeah, maybe something we can talk about by the end of summer.
Yeah, could be. Could be.
Thank you for calling. Willem in Colfax, your turn. Hi, Willem.
Hi. I was just wondering about your opinion about these cuts to the National Weather Service and how that might affect, you know, early warning systems or more regional radar, and also the current administration's climate change denial. The President Trump calls it a hoax. I wonder how that affects the funding for research and how that might, the future of climate study and the Weather Service.
Yeah, good questions and important questions of the day. The cuts that have been recklessly and thoughtlessly done to NOAA and especially to the National Weather Service have put us as a nation in a position where we are not ready for the severe weather season, which includes the tornado season. And as Larry and I were just talking about, that migrates from one region to the next across the country over the next 6 months. And we're not ready for the hurricane season, because there'll be information that we need that is now no longer quite at our fingertips as it was before, that will inform hurricane prediction, both intensity, severity, and location of impact. So these are all negative consequences of a reckless and poorly thought out, absolutely lacking any analysis of trying to make changes at NOAA or more specifically the Weather Service. And I don't want to come across as sounding like someone who doesn't think that it's important to constantly revise and review programs and operations in some of these big organizations. That's perfectly legitimate concern and a legitimate activity to engage in. What isn't legitimate is doing it without any analysis at all and simply running in with a hatchet and cutting things to pieces and then throwing away what you consider the debris. That's going to cost lives across our country. There's no question about it. It's only a matter of when and where. It's going to cost lives. And then on the longer term, making, you know, ridiculous statements to the effect that the climate change and climate science and predictions about what's going to happen in the future are a hoax. It's nonsensical. This is coming from a guy who doesn't know how to put in a good day's work on any problem, He never has demonstrated that. He certainly isn't demonstrating it now. Anything that requires work, analysis, or any real significant effort is not something he's interested in. And so it's easy to just call it a hoax. The problem is it's not a hoax, and the real world is going to intervene in ways that will make itself quite well known, and that's going to impact Americans for the next 50 years in ways that we were beginning to start to pull back on. And now we're going to have a period of time where all of those efforts are going to be going have gone for naught for a period of time. And the problem with the climate issue is that it's the integrated result of treating our environment in a certain way, either with a lack of respect, which I think we're in now, or with a certain sort of respect, pressured by our interests in making sure we can continue to make a living and have a lifestyle. That was a better way to do it than what we're doing now, which is absolutely no regard at all for the environment. And it's going to come back and bite us. There's no doubt about it.
John Martin, our guest today, professor and former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison, our guest. You can join in with your questions or comments. The number, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're talking climate and weather today with one of our weather guys, John Martin, from the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. John, we had a question about vapor pressure. Talking about rising temperatures and precipitation makes you think about humidity. And this person wonders, how is humidity measured, and how does humidity relate to vapor pressure?
Yeah, there's a number of ways to measure the amount of water vapor that's in the air. That's invisible water gas. You can't see it any more than you can see oxygen or nitrogen. It's invisible. And there's a number of ways to measure it. One of those ways is to take a sample of air into the lab and actually weigh the water vapor molecules and figure out what the ratio of their mass to the rest of the mass of the air parcel is, and that's called the mixing ratio. Another way, though, is to figure out how much pressure is exerted just by the water vapor molecules in the sample, because it's made up, the sample will be made up of nitrogen, oxygen, water vapor, carbon dioxide, a whole bunch of different chemicals. The air is a mixture on our planet. And you can, I don't know how, I'm not a chemist, but you can go in and figure out what fraction of that total pressure is exerted by those water vapor molecules. And that fraction is called the vapor pressure. And so that, one really thinks about it most frequently in meteorological terms as a means to measure the water vapor content. And if you know that the air is saturated with respect to water, that is, you can't stuff another water vapor molecule into it without condensing one out, then the pressure exerted by that collection of water vapor molecules is called the saturation vapor pressure. That depends only on the temperature. So that's pretty wild. It's very cool. And it affords us some really interesting ways to and informative ways to measure the humidity.
Oh, really interesting. Yeah. Julie in Fond du Lac has something for us. Let's go there.
Hi there. Thanks for the program, as always. Just wanted to say a very sincere thank you to your guests for their response regarding federal budget cuts to NOAA and the National Weather Service. I really appreciate the thoughtful and comprehensive response. I think it's rare now that really people are willing to say the truth and say what's in front of us so that we all can really take it in. And one thing I wondered is I didn't hear if his response included ramifications in terms of farmers and how they use the Weather Service for benefits in their work.
So. Yeah, it's an excellent point. It's an absolutely excellent point. The notion that farmers wanting to know about soil moisture, they have the U.S. Drought Monitor is tied to NOAA and it's tied to the Weather Service. And any cuts that are made to that it at a minimum reduces the amount of information transfer between individual farmers, large farms or small, and important weather information. And I know that when you're, cutting hay or cutting grass or whatever it is on the farm, you need to have a reasonably accurate two-day forecast to make sure you know when to do it, or there's a lot at risk. And the idea that we're taking fewer observations than we used to for no reason at all, except to say that we're slashing budgets to satisfy somebody's whim, is not an effective way to inform our economy and to support it.
Julie, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Let's go to Sherry in Townsend next. Hi, Sherry.
Hi. I'm wondering how jet streams can affect our climate and if they could be actually used to manipulate the weather.
Yeah, the jet stream is a really important weather-producing phenomenon in the middle latitudes of the Earth, where we live in places further north in our hemisphere. And it has undulations, that is, ups and downs, peaks and valleys, I guess we call them ridges and troughs on horizontal maps, across the entire hemisphere. And those are highly variable, but the position of troughs and ridges affects the position of surface low-pressure systems, which bring clouds, precipitation, and in the wintertime, snowstorms, and regions of surface high pressure, which often are associated with clear skies. In the summertime, beautiful weather. In the wintertime, sometimes some of the coldest weather that we can get are associated with them. The jet is at about 6 miles above the ground, and its position is controlled on the broadest possible scale by the temperature difference between the North Pole and the equator, which is always colder to the north. And so the jet is always moving from west to east or some fraction thereof. Trying to manipulate the jet stream is something I've not heard very much discussion about, and I think it's because people realize that the way in which the jet evolves, it combines not only responses to large-scale weather systems in the subtropics and the tropics, even though the jet doesn't migrate there, but it responds to weather systems that are produced there, hurricanes, tropical storms, and tropical convective clusters, which don't maybe mature into tropical storms. In addition, the jet can evolve due to some internal dynamics over which we have little or no control. And so trying to harness the jet and make it do what we want seems to me to be a hopeless problem. Using it to better observe the atmosphere is another matter. You can put little blimps up into the jet stream, have them reside at a certain pressure level, and circumnavigate the globe, taking periodic measurements that we wouldn't otherwise have. That's a valuable way to take advantage of the presence and undulations of the jet stream. But the other one is be great if we could do it, but we can't. It's too large scale and way too powerful.
Oh, there we go. Thank you, Sherry, for calling. Dean in Evergreen, Colorado, your turn. Hi, Dean.
Hi, good afternoon. And thanks for putting on the show. I always appreciate it every last Monday of the month. I spent my career as a research meteorologist, and I was just wondering what John's finger on the pulse might be for the new crop of grad and undergrad students in view of what's going on. I know that the federal government is a major employer for research meteorologists. Whether that's sort of having a noticeable character in terms of how your students are looking at things there going forward.
Yeah, I think currently there's a lot of discouragement among our student body, and I try to rally them to the realization that whatever is going on now has a limit. It has a fuse that's going to burn out. It can't go beyond 2028, and the country will realize how many terrible mistakes have already been made in terms of providing services to people with respect to the weather and climate. And the country will not tolerate the continuance of that willful ignorance. And that's my sense. And I try to instill that and convince my students of that so that what they should be focusing on, I've been telling them this a lot this year, and I don't like to have to burden them with extra things, but I like to tell them, your job is to become excellent. At the University of Wisconsin, we can help you do that. And you must keep your head down, and we'll get our way out of this this period of darkness. And when we do, there's going to be a tremendous need for your expertise and your knowledge and your training. So try and think of this as a dark cocoon and just keep on working hard, and we'll help you do that. So I'm hoping I'm winning their hearts and their minds to that view, but I can't tell. It's only been a few months, less than 100 days.
Dean, there you go. Thank you for calling. Jerry in Kokana, let's go to you next. Hi, Jerry.
Hello, and thanks, John. I really, really appreciate it, and encourage people to call their congressmen to let them know their feelings. But My question is, because of the storms today, is there any apps that you use on your phone to be alerted for, like, a tornado or something?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't really use anything that other people don't use. I don't have any particular insights that way. I'm not a particularly tech-oriented guy. But I do look at my department's website for its depiction of, on various different regional scales, the reflectivity from the radar. So that's something that I do like to pay attention to on days like today. If I were in the La Crosse area, especially later this afternoon, I'd be thinking about looking at some form of the radar reflectivity just to make sure I saw what was coming along. And then I think the other thing is to just pay attention to the National Weather Service website pages, either at La Crosse or Milwaukee or Green Bay in our state, because they're going to be updating as soon as they can with information about, you know, warnings and all kinds of other information about where you might go if you're in a various location as the severe weather bears down on us. So thank God that the Weather Service websites are still up and running, and I think on days like today especially, they're going to be at their, you know, full capacity trying to alert the public.
Jerry, thank you for calling. Arcelli in Madison will go to you next. Hi.
Yes, hi. I was really enjoying this conversation, and thank you so much for your guest. When you're talking about, like, climate change, and, you know, who would be the most vulnerable populations that will be affected by the climate change? We oftentimes hear this word of environmental racism, et cetera, and I don't feel like people really understand why we say those words. And so if your guest could possibly break down that, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know a little bit about that, and I have a couple of examples in mind. One thing one can say is that one of the elements of climate change is that the ice in the high latitudes, both of the northern and southern hemisphere, is melting at a greater rate than it used to. And so that tends to raise sea levels. The water just can't disappear from the face of the earth. It doesn't disappear and not affect sea levels. So there are many nations, island nations in the Pacific, for instance, that are seeing the shoreline encroach upon their land. And, you know, these are not often the biggest countries, but they're countries where people are living and have lived for centuries. And they're starting to see an erosion of the arable land and actually the solid earth that on which they can continue to have their families thrive. So that's one place. They don't have a lot of political clout because they're small countries and they're not particularly wealthy countries. So that's clearly an example of, you know, an imposition being put upon them by industrialized nations that they cannot fight politically or economically. Other examples, maybe not directly related to the climate, are examples of the so-called Black Belt in Mississippi and Alabama, where the soil is extraordinarily fertile. This is a place where a lot of former slaves became farmers in that part of those two states. And when the argument was made about where to put the Doppler radar sites across Alabama and Mississippi, the political influences at the time kept those locations from being well covered by the Doppler radar. So they're among the worst places to get warnings about tornadoes and other severe weather in the spring. And there's, you know, thousands of farmers trying to make a living there. They need that information as much as anyone else. So when decisions are made that marginalize a community for whatever the reason is, in that case, it was, you know, longstanding racism in the South, that you end up putting people at risk to changes that are occurring in the environment or even regular run-of-the-mill activities of the environment like tornadic activity in the South. But if it gets more frequent and more vicious, then the deficit of information becomes more critical. And so there's all kinds of things like that that we need to pay attention to make sure that as we plan for the future of a different climate system, we're making sure that we are accounting for all of the possible shortcomings that we've had in the past.
Thank you very much for that question. I wanted to mention climate centers for just a minute, because four of the six regional climate centers in the nation were shut down earlier this month, then including the Midwest Center, which covers Wisconsin. But they reopened about a week later and are set to renew their contracts with NOAA in June. What do these climate centers do, and what do they do? And what do you make of the reopening?
Yeah, the reopening is the flip side of the reckless closing. So, you know, and realizing almost immediately that was a very stupid and poorly thought out move. The Midwest Climate Center monitors soil moisture, among other things. It has a direct interaction with the Illinois Water Survey, which does a tremendous job about agricultural interests in both Illinois and southern Wisconsin, maybe even more than southern Wisconsin. But the Midwest Climate Center is an excellent organization that is, as you say, Larry, tied to NOAA and provides really a wealth. I can't even describe how much. A wealth of information for the agricultural world as well as public interest in weather and climate. So it's extremely important, and I'm so glad that they were quickly brought back online, because this summer would have been, their absence would have been felt critically this summer if that was not online for a variety of reasons, maybe most of them being agricultural reasons.
NOAA announced this month that the world's coral reefs are in the midst of the largest bleaching event, global bleaching event on record. What do you, can you explain in a minute or so what that means and why we think it's occurring?
I wish I knew for sure. I'm going to say what I think is the case, but I'm not sure that I'm right. I think as the carbon dioxide fraction, dissolved carbon dioxide fraction in water, the seawater goes up, because the carbon dioxide fraction in the atmosphere goes up, it acidifies the ocean water, and that is very bad for coral. And I think that, and coral's a living organism. And so when it gets bleached, it's not just changing the color of what you see as a piece of rock, you know, ancient coral at a gift shop. It's killing organisms that provide a tremendous service by filtering the water that's in and around fishing areas and also close to land masses. And so this is a really critical part of the ecosystem in ways I can't describe with any intelligence. But we're killing a living organism that plays that critical cornerstone role in large-scale ecosystems around the globe in the oceans. And so it's not a good thing. And it's a function of carbon dioxide fraction.
On that note, John, we are out of time. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I appreciate it. We'll get you
great
for
to
the
be
last
here.
Monday of next month.
All right. Great to be here.
John Martin, professor and former chair of the, and current member of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. And thank you for listening today. And thanks to our team today. Clara Neipert, Joel Patnott, our producers, technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, who also produces shows like this one. Our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.